You're listening to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. I'm Garrett Ashley Mullet, and I want to talk about everything. After this, David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. And he took Gath and its villages out of the hand of the Philistines. And he defeated Moab. And the Moabites became servants to David and brought tribute. David also defeated Hadadezer, king of Zobah Hamath, as he went to set up his monument at the river Euphrates. And David took from him 1,000 chariots, 7,000 horsemen, and 20,000 foot soldiers. And David hamstrung all the chariot horses, but left enough for 100 chariots. And when the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, king of Zobah, David struck down 22,000 men of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became servants to David and brought tribute. And Yahweh gave victory to David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that were carried by the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem. And from Tibbeth and from Kun, cities of Hadadezer, David took a large amount of bronze. With it, Solomon made the bronze sea and the pillars and the vessels of bronze. When Tou, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated the whole army of Hadadezer, king of Zobah, he sent his son, Hadoram, to King David to ask about his health and to bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him. For Hadadezer had often been at war with Tou. And he sent all sorts of articles of gold, of silver, and of bronze. These also King David dedicated to Yahweh, together with the silver and gold that he had carried off from all the nations, from Edom, Moab, the Ammonites, the Philistines, and Amalek. And Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, killed 18,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt. Then he put garrisons in Edom. And all the Edomites became David's servants. And Yahweh gave victory to David wherever he went. So David reigned over all Israel, and he administered justice and equity to all his people. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. And Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. And Zadok, the son of Ahitub, and Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, were priests. And Shavsha was secretary. And Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Cherethites and the Pelethites, and David's sons were the chief officials in the service of the king. Welcome back to the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show. This is Garrett Ashley Mullet coming to you from Greeley, Colorado for episode 837 of this podcast. The date is Monday, April 1st, 2024. No, I am not fooling. It is definitely April 1st. If I tell you some things that are silly, I will not be joking. I think. I'm pretty sure all day. I really don't typically do the April Fool's thing. Sometimes it's done to me. Anyways, it is definitely April 1st, 2024. This is the Garrett Ashley Mullet Show, where I want to talk about everything. And that does not mean that I will always have all the answers. And it won't even necessarily be, as you'll find, if you haven't figured this out yet from listening to this point, I don't always necessarily even ask the right questions, but one thing I am confident of is that it is a feature of our existence that we know in part. We don't have complete knowledge. We don't know everything. We don't understand what it is that we do know. There are things that we don't know that we don't know, and even the things that we're pretty sure we know, sometimes they are assumptions. Maybe they're guesses or they're speculative. Maybe they're rumors. Maybe they are what someone else told us and we thought it was true. We thought that was the case, or maybe we misunderstood them. So we think we know a thing, but we don't necessarily know it. April Fools is something that we say when we're intentionally telling people a shocking bit of news, and we're expecting, we're assuming that there's a kind of absolution. However upset they get, however surprised or shocked or excited or sad or angry or whatever, we're expecting that when they realize that today is April 1st, after they've been told this thing, they're going to just let it slide. Oh, you got me. April 1st. Yeah, I guess I should have known. That's on me, right? It's a funny thing that, because the rest of the year, presumably, different rules apply. And when people tell you things that are not so, there is no hiding behind what day of the year it is. So April 1st is kind of a holiday of sorts for telling people totally made up news, totally made up stories, and then laughing at them when they believe you. But then the flip side is, if you condition people to expect that surprising news they find out on the 1st of April is not going to be true, then you could just tell people things that are true that you don't want them to believe on April 1st and then leave them guessing, right? Tell them shocking things that are true and hope that they don't believe it. But I'm getting ahead of myself. In this episode, we're going to be talking about Resurrection Sunday, which was yesterday. And we're going to be talking about the 2 days of the year, if no other days, if no other Sundays in particular, they will go to church in the West. They will very often at least go on Christmas and on Easter. Easter Sunday, if they don't go to church the rest of the year, if they're invited by friends or family, if they grew up in a Christian family or they feel some connection with the Christian faith, they have friends who are Christians, they may try out church on Easter Sunday. If they're nominally Christian, they don't really have strong convictions, they're not really devout, they're not very religious, they're not disciplined about it, or they're not consistent about it, they'll at least go on Easter. And if there's one other, it's going to be Christmas or the Sunday right before Christmas. That's when they'll go. If there's a Christmas Eve service, maybe they'll go to that. But those are pretty much the 1, 2, or 3 punch combo for the bare minimum on church attendance in the course of a calendar year. The early, early church met daily, it says, in one another's homes, and they broke bread and they encouraged one another. They held all things in common. It says in various places, they gave all of their possessions away or sold all their possessions and gave the proceeds to the poor. It says in some places in the New Testament. In other places, we see that they met in public places. And so it really depended on where in the Christian world and when and what was going on. And for the last 2,000 years or so, it's varied, it's fluctuated a little bit. But what we seem to have settled on, for the most part, most of us, is Sunday morning is the time when the really devout Christians, the really disciplined ones, are going to get together in a church building. A public profession of faith is implied by their attending, especially if they're regular. If they're singing the songs, there's a confessional aspect to that. If they're taking communion, there's a confessional aspect to that. If they've been baptized, if they express Christian faith verbally, then all of that goes together. But if maybe they used to, or they grew up that way and they've grown out of it, or they've moved on, or they've kind of drifted away, or they had a bad experience, they moved somewhere else, whatever it is, maybe they just go on Easter and Christmas and the rest of the year, it's just not a priority. Well, as it turns out, I have some thoughts to share with you about how our family did it a little bit differently this year. And I'll explain why. And I hope it will be helpful to you. It will at least get some things off my chest, but I think also it'll be helpful for me and for my house. And insofar as I'm doing this in good faith, or at least sincerely, I'm saying what I will say in a genuineness. I have reason to believe it will be helpful to you as well, or at least that it has a high probability of being helpful to you. But before we get into all of that, let's talk about the reading from the top of the episode, 1 Chronicles chapter 18. Not exactly an Easter passage, but this is where we're at, reading through a chapter at a time. Here we see David defeating his enemies, and then we see David's administration. David, being a forefather of Jesus, we find a work in, and maybe it's good for us to remember from time to time that when God promised to David in the previous chapter that God would build a house for David and a name for David and a reputation for David, instead of David being the one to build the temple, to build a house for the Ark of God and for the name of God, maybe sometimes it's good for us to remember that Jesus being descended from David is promised in the previous chapter, 1 Chronicles chapter 17. And it comes to pass. We see that in the genealogies, in the gospel accounts in the New Testament. It's traced back, the lineage of Jesus, to David. But here we've got David behaving in a way that is not, in our day, at least not in the United States of America, regarded as what you would expect from a Christian, not in a very Christian way. David defeated the Philistines and subdued them. He conquered them thoroughly. He took Gath away from them and its villages. He also defeated Moab, and the Moabites became servants to David, and they brought tribute. Well, that doesn't sound very Christian. David defeated Hadadezer, some king who was a bit of a problem to another king who sent his son. Tou was the other king. Hearing that David had defeated this Hadadezer, he sends his son to bless David, to inquire after his health. Hey, how are you doing? I just wanted to say thanks. That guy's always been a problem for us. We really appreciate you taking care of Hadadezer. Here, have some treasure. David says, if I may paraphrase, thanks. Yeah, we'll just put this with the rest, dedicated to Yahweh, our God. But it says here that the Moabites, the Philistines, Hadadezer, the Syrians got involved, the Edomites, all these peoples had scraps with Israel as David was king over Israel. And lest you suppose David was just doing his own thing, it says that God gave David the victory. So it wasn't that David is kind of just doing his own thing over here, fighting with these peoples, winning battles, winning wars, subduing enemies, exacting tribute, building up treasure, winning peace, not just for Israel, but also for other kingdoms who had issues with some of these neighbors of Israel. It says in verse 13, Yahweh gave victory to David wherever he went. Almost as if God was more than okay with David winning these battles and winning these wars. You get the impression that maybe God was more than okay with the battles that David was fighting when God gave David victory wherever he went. I get that impression. I get that distinct impression. Lastly, verse 14, also very important for getting the other side of the equation. You get one side of the equation when it comes to foreign affairs, where David is defeating neighboring peoples, neighboring kingdoms. But then, how are things going domestically? Well, it says, verse 14, David reigned over all Israel, and he administered justice and equity to all his people. I take two lessons away from this, as pertains to good government, government that God has blessed. One, government that God has blessed does not necessarily avoid every fight, skip every battle, sue for peace instead of having any wars. No, no. There is such a thing as a just war, and when the war is just, however terrible it may be, at the same time that it's just a country, a kingdom, a nation, a people blessed by God wins the battles and the wars. And which battles and wars they fight, very much informed, no doubt about it, by whether they love God and they fear God and they obey God and they keep his commandments and they meditate on his precepts and his statutes. And you might say, well, that was just for then, but then doesn't that create a significant problem when God gave victory to other nations at various times? Yes, I think so. So I think this is not just Israel and it's not just David, but I think it is known perfectly to God what is the distinction at various times when he blesses a nation with victory in battle, in war, and domestically when God blesses a nation with a government that administers justice and equity to all its people. David does that. He administers justice and equity. If you have only equity, I think what you basically get is socialism, redistribute to get equal outcomes for everybody. That's not just. If you only have justice by the letter of the law, I think you get severity and harshness. And there's no mercy. There's no kindness. There's no tenderness. How can anyone endure when it's just justice? But then Micah 6:8 comes to mind. He has shown you, O man, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. Those three things, God requiring, go together, and they may seem like they're contradictory, but they can't be contradictory, as though God is setting us up to fail. When we do the one thing, we're not doing the other thing, as though God can only be just or merciful. And of course, that's not the case. If he says, be holy for I am holy, even though we don't perfectly do that, that we're called to it is undeniable. God is just and merciful. And even though we can't perfectly imitate that either, nevertheless, that he has called us to it is, I would say, indisputable. So, David reigns over all Israel. He administers justice and equity to all his people. I think the equity piece here is to say that there's a recognition of the need for mercy when it is appropriate. And sometimes what we call mercy is really just inappropriate application of an otherwise good principle or a good priority. In other cases, it would be, but if you're letting off the guilty who are flagrant, who are transgressive and malicious, they're evildoers, they're lawless, they're not penitent, they're not contrite, they feel no sadness, there's no remorse, they don't regret at all doing the bad thing that they do. You let them off, and you actually are just promoting and rewarding bad behavior. And you'll get more of what? Bad behavior. You have to do justice, in some sense, in order to give equity or administer equity. And why do I say that? Because one person may have harmed, injured, damaged, or even destroyed another person. And if you're going to make the one who's been harmed, the victim, whole in any respect, you're going to have to take back from the one who did the taking in the first place. And it doesn't become just more of the same when you take back from the one who did the taking in the first place. If somebody steals my car and I call the police and the police go and they retrieve my car and they take it away from the person who stole it from me and they bring it back to me, the police are not stealing like the person who stole the vehicle from me was stealing. No, the person who stole from me was stealing because it was my car. I owned it. I had the title for it. I paid for it. It was my property. Well, so also, there's quite a lot in justice that works that way domestically, and there's quite a lot in international affairs, foreign affairs, that works that way. And it's uncareful and it's unwise to suppose that there's something ungodly, unholy, unrighteous, if a government bears the sword for something, whether domestically or internationally, to take life from someone who is going around and taking life in a murderous sort of a way is not the same thing as if you were that person in the first place who just goes around willy-nilly being violent, being murderous. It is not the commandment, thou shalt not kill. If it was the commandment, thou shalt not kill, then it would be very odd. It would be very confusing, very contradictory. It would introduce a conflict within the character of God for God to give the victory to David wherever he goes here in verse 13. But then it isn't the same. Killing and murder are not the same. You can presume that there is a just cause, that these are just wars that David and Israel are fighting against the Philistines, the Moabites, Hadadezer, the Syrians, Edom, the Ammonites, Amalek. These are just wars. One, because these peoples have sinned against God. Two, because these peoples have sinned against Israel. They've been just awful, and they intend to keep on being awful. And the only way to get them to stop being awful is to apply force to the problem. Now, domestically, if you have individuals being awful, sometimes the only thing for it is to apply force to the problem. But if you get somebody who loves that too much, and they go by the letter of the law, maybe they're actually the one who loves violence, and they're filling the land with violence by making up excuses, making up laws for people to have transgressed so that they can go after them in a harsh way. And then they call it justice, or they call it equity, but it's not either. Who ultimately decides what justice and equity should be, or how we should think of them, is God. And it all really comes down to understanding what is yours, what rightly belongs to you, and if somebody else takes it away from you, they've wronged you, they've sinned against you, they've done evil. When you don't know what rightly belongs to you, and you start talking about things that don't rightly belong to you as if they did belong to you, that throws the whole equation out of whack. And if you enlist the government to get back for you something that never belonged to you in the first place, or to punish someone for taking something away from you that never belonged to you in the first place, then you're actually committing a kind of fraud. And if the government knows better, so is the government. And that is also partly the explanation for how war can be justified, that one country goes to war against another, one nation goes to war against another nation, in part that the government of one country is that way. They are corrupt, and so they want to find an excuse. Maybe they make up an excuse to go against their neighbor and to try and take what belongs to their neighbor and to act as though, oh, that was always ours. That always belonged to us. How dare you? You took that from us. Ah, but if it's not true, then, oh, no, you don't. And the cynics will say, well, but everybody does that. And that's just a lazy way of not picking a side and not having to be loyal to anybody and not having to get involved. It's just a lazy way of saying, I'm selfish and I don't want to care about anybody but myself. I don't want to risk my life and limb. I don't want to risk my reputation. I'm just not going to pick a side. I'm going to say everybody's equally wrong. That is not evidence of good character, strong character, integrity, virtue, honor. But what is how David engages, at least as far as it goes, in chapter 18 here of 1 Chronicles, that God gives him victory wherever he goes, and that he reigns over Israel, administering justice and equity to all his people without partiality. Speaks very well of him, but you don't do the international piece of this or the domestic piece of this when you're the sort of person who says, well, everybody's wrong. No, it's not possible to administer justice when that's the way you approach every lawsuit, every court case. Well, nobody's perfect. Everybody's wrong. Okay, you're all punished. Wait, that's, no. Okay, well, you all get whatever you want. That's not possible. You know, there are mutually exclusive truth claims that are made by people when they go to court against each other or when they go to war against each other. And it's possible that all the claims are not true in a particular case, but it's much more likely that certain claims are more true than others. And in that case, you should probably support, in the interest of loving truth and rejoicing in the truth, the more true case, as far as you know. You may say, well, I don't know everything. I don't know near enough because I don't know everything. Well, wait a second. You're never going to know everything. And if your stipulation is you will not make a decision, you will not participate, you will not get involved, you will not stick your neck out there until you know everything, then that's as good as saying you're never going to get involved. And maybe that's just, again, an indirect way of saying you only care about yourself. You're lazy or selfish or cowardly. You love the praise of men too much, or you love your life too much. But then it's not possible for you to administer justice or equity to the people if you're in a position of leadership and that's how you are. And it's not possible for you to prosecute a just war against meaningful enemies if that's how you're going to be. You will not have the respect of your people, either on a field of battle or in a court of law or in the court of public opinion. And soon enough, you will, if you're that way, lose the position of authority. God himself, likely, as biblical examples show us, will remove you. Just like we believe that God raises up people to be in positions of authority, he also brings them low. And it's appropriate for us to pray and ask God for wisdom for our leaders so that they will know how to make wise decisions. It's appropriate for us to ask God to bless us with wisdom with regards to how we relate to those in authority over us so that we can live peaceable lives, so that we have a good conscience and a good testimony. We honor him in the midst of all of it. But I think at a certain point, depending on what kind of a situation we're in, it's appropriate for us to pray that the Lord would give us better leaders, better authorities who have more integrity. They are more virtuous. They promote justice and equity boldly. Ultimately, our hope is in God. It's not in princes. We don't put our hope in princes, but that doesn't mean you pay no attention to who the princes are. Let's take a look here at the commentary from Matthew Henry for a moment, shall we? And then we'll talk a little bit about how my family related to Easter Sunday this year. Chapter 18, Matthew Henry writes, David's piety and his prayer we had an account of in the foregoing chapter. Here follows immediately that which one might reasonably expect, an account of his prosperity. For those that seek first the kingdom of God and the righteousness thereof, as David did, shall have other things added to them as far as God sees good for them. Here is, 1, his prosperity abroad. He conquered the Philistines, verse 1, the Moabites, verse 2, the king of Zobah, verse 3 and 4, the Syrians, verses 5 to 8, made the king of Hamath his tributary, verses 9 to 11, and the Edomites, verse 12 and verse 13. 2, his prosperity at home, his court and kingdom flourished, verses 14 to 17. All this we had an account of before, 2 Samuel chapter 8. After this, regarding verses 1 to 8, it is said, verse 1, David did those great exploits after the sweet communion he had had with God by the word and prayer, as mentioned in the foregoing chapter. He went on his work with extraordinary vigor and courage, conquering and to conquer. Thus Jacob, after his vision, lifted up his feet. Genesis 29:1. We have taken a view of these victories before, and shall now only observe, 1, those that have been long enemies to the Israel of God will be brought down at last. The Philistines had, for some several generations, been vexatious to Israel, but now David subdued them, verse 1. Thus shall all opposing rule, principality, and power be, at the end of time, put down by the Son of David, and the most inveterate enemies shall fall before him. 2, such is the uncertainty of this world that frequently men lose their wealth and power when they think to confirm it. Hadrezer was smitten as he went to establish his dominion, verse 3. 3, a horse is a vain thing for safety, so David said, Psalm 33:17. And it seems he believed what he said, for he hoed the chariot horses, verse 4, being resolved not to trust to them, Psalm 20, verse 7, he would not use them. Number 4, the enemies of God's church are often made to ruin themselves by helping one another, verse 5. The Syrians of Damascus were smitten when they came to help Hadrezer. When hand thus joins in hand, they shall not only not go unpunished, but thereby they shall be gathered as the sheaves into the floor, Micah 4, verses 11 and 12. Number 5, the wealth of the sinner sometimes proves to have been laid up for the just. The Syrians brought gifts, verse 6. Their shields of gold and their brass were brought to Jerusalem, verses 7 and 8. As the tabernacle was built on the spoils of the Egyptians, so the temple of the spoils of other Gentile nations, a happy presage of the interest the Gentiles should have in the gospel church. Regarding verses 9 to 17, here let us learn, one, that it is our interest to make those our friends who have the presence of God with them. The king of Hamath, hearing of David's great success, sent to congratulate him and court his favor with a noble present, verses 9 and 10. It is in vain to contend with the son of David. Kiss the son, therefore, lest he be angry. Let the kings and judges of the earth and all inferior people too be thus wise, thus instructed. The presents we are to bring him are not vessels of gold and silver, as here. Those shall be welcomed to him who have no such presents to bring. But our hearts and sincere affections, our whole selves, we must present to him as living sacrifices. Two, that what God blesses us with, we must honor him with. The presence of his friends, as well as the spoils of his enemies, David dedicated unto Yahweh, verse 11, that is, he laid them up towards the building and enriching of the temple, that is most truly and most comfortably our own, which we have consecrated unto the Lord, and which we use for his glory. Let our merchandise and our hire be holiness to the Lord, Isaiah 23, verse 18. Number three, that those who take God along with them whithersoever they go may expect to prosper and be preserved whithersoever they go. It was said before, verse 6, and here it is repeated, verse 13, that the Lord preserved David whithersoever he went. Those are always under the eye of God that have God always in their eye. Verse 4, God gives men power, not that they may look great with it, but that they may do good with it. When David reigned over all Israel, he executed judgment and justice among all his people, and so answered the end of his elevation. He was not so intent on his conquests abroad as to neglect the administration of justice at home. Herein he served the purposes of the kingdom of providence and of that God who sits in the throne judging right. And he was an imminent type of the Messiah, the scepter of whose kingdom is a right scepter. That concludes the commentary from Matthew Henry. And a link will be in the description for this podcast episode. You can go check it out. It's filed under Thoughts on the Reading. You can check out the rest of Matthew Henry's commentaries as well for free online at Blue Letter Bible if you're interested. For now, let's talk about Resurrection Sunday and what is typically referred to as Easter weekend. Never mind about the backstory. I've talked about the backstory before in previous Easters on this podcast. You can go and check out episodes I published previous Easters to get some thoughts on this whole idea of the pagan origins of us calling it Easter. Never mind about that. Or go check out those episodes if you want to hear some commentary of that sort on that question. This year, we have something rather perverse and much more contemporary to deal with. What is not disputable, like the angst some Christians feel about celebrating Christmas with Christmas trees or celebrating Easter with Easter eggs or even chocolate Easter eggs, because that might come from paganism. That's disputable. What's not disputable this Easter, this Resurrection Sunday in 2024, the year of our Lord, is that the President of the United States of America, for one, forbade any sort of religious symbols on the eggs that were decorated for the annual Easter egg hunt at the White House. That's number one. Number two, he declared March 31st, Resurrection Sunday, Trans Day of Visibility. The governor of the state of New York lit up monuments across the state with the flag of trans activists. And the White House signaled, I think probably in the clearest possible terms to this point, not just an ambivalence with regards to Christianity, but by picking that most holy of days in the calendar for Christians for 2,000 some years to be a trans day of visibility, and saying nothing about Resurrection Sunday, Christians celebrating Easter. the President of the United States of America expressed the intentions of his administration and of his party to be anti-Christian. In fact, to be as provocative towards Christians, to be as contemptuous of Christians in the U.S. and around the world as possible. You could liken this proclamation and the juxtaposition of these two decisions made to the so-called modern art piece installation, but really just death work known as Piss Christ, in which a crucifix was submerged in a vat of urine. Ah, this is what you hold to be dear and sacred. This is what you revere, this Christ and his crucifixion, his death, burial, and resurrection. This is what you have so much reverence for. I'll show you what I think of it. It was, unless I'm mistaken, the single most irreverent public act or proclamation of any U.S. president in America's history. Our whole country is abuzz about it, and the whole world is watching and listening and wondering what the United States of America is going to do next. Trump, for his part, released a statement in which he described Joe Biden's statement as flat-out blasphemous. I'm inclined to agree. You know, it's interesting, in the period between the last of the Old Testament prophets and the first of the New Testament gospel accounts, there's a bit of Jewish history that would be good for us to become acquainted with if we're not yet. But there was a certain Hellenistic king who wanted to show the Jews in Palestine exactly what he thought of them. And he slaughtered a pig in the temple just to let them know, this is what I think of your codes of clean and unclean animals. This is what I think of your religion. Not only did he slaughter a pig in the temple, but then he made the priests eat the pork, which was unclean for them to eat. This was so incendiary, it led to a major revolt on the part of the Jews, the Maccabean Revolt. And it is, oh, by the way, the Maccabean Revolt that is commemorated annually with Hanukkah. But here's the thing. What Antiochus Epiphanes was doing with the swine and the temple and the Jews, in particular the priests, he did from the same headspace that I believe the Democrats are operating from right now in relation to Christianity. Try to take over Christianity and to use Christianity, to use the church in America as a vehicle for accomplishing a complete overhaul of our definitions of justice and equity. And of course, once that's accomplished, the Democrats install themselves as the forever uniparty, one-party rule, administering justice and equity for all the people, along the lines of this new set of definitions for justice and equity. But if that doesn't seem to be working, if increasingly these Christians are saying, no, that's not sound doctrine. That is not what God has called us to. That is not what God commands. That's not his purpose. That's not holy. That's not righteous. That's not just. That's not equitable. That's actually very unjust. That's very crooked. That's very corrupt. That's very wicked. Repent. Then switch gears and perhaps let the whole world know exactly what little esteem you hold these Christians and their faith in. Mock them, revile them, persecute them. If you can't co-opt their Christianity and make it useful and thereby make them useful to your purposes, then destroy them and their faith. Now, to be clear, Resurrection Sunday is not contingent on a presidential proclamation. And you might say, well, as we get to be increasingly populated by people who express no religious affiliation, this is going to just be more and more the case because not everybody's a Christian. No, listen, there's more to it than just not everybody's a Christian. the Trans Day of Visibility being declared on the exact same day as Resurrection Sunday in a proclamation from this president has no parallel with how important days for other religions are treated. How would it be if on some very holy Hindu day, the president of the United States issued a proclamation, this day is going to be National Cattle Farmers Day of Visibility, or whatever. That would be unthinkable. They wouldn't do that, but then they wouldn't have as much reason to do that when there's so much contempt, there's so much disgust, there's so much bad blood between the Democrats, in particular Joe Biden, and conservative Christians. And it's the conservative Christians who are not playing ball. They're not going along with this. So they're the ones that you really want to revile. They're the ones who need to have their faces rubbed in the dirt as the Democrats see it. Increasingly, the messaging from the Democrats in media and in office is that conservative Christians are dangerous. They're potentially violent extremists. They have no business actually speaking in public, particularly in venues where the general public might be gearing up to make a decision of a political nature, of a public policy nature, of a civil government nature, or even with regards to education, to have a debate about such things. No, these conservative Christians have no inherent right, as far as the Democrats see it. If we're educating our own children, that's dangerous. If we're operating our businesses according to our Christian convictions, our own privately owned businesses, that's dangerous. That can't be tolerated. The next thing is we can't have them practicing their religion even publicly. And so we're going to say, nope, this is not Resurrection Sunday. This is the Trans Day of Visibility, which sounds remarkably like the Trans Day of Vengeance, wherein transgendered shooters, now not one, but a few, have targeted Christian schools, churches, to get a kind of revenge. Or that's at least what their manifestos, as far as I've seen leaks of their manifestos, that's what their manifestos say. That's what their social media profiles say. This is payback for these hateful Christians, because their words are violence. They're teaching that transgenderism is an abomination and that it is totally contrary to what God tells us his purpose was for making us male and female. Their teaching on that is violence against us. And so we're just fighting back. That's what the Trans Day of Vengeance folks say. That's their motive for the president of the United States of America to say, Resurrection Sunday is a trans day of visibility, is just to change up one little word, and not even the whole word, because the first letter is still the same. It's basically to affirm as good what the Trans Day of Vengeance folks were going for, to say they're really the good guys in this story, and it's these Christians preaching what the Bible actually says, teaching what the Bible actually says, trying to live according to what the Bible actually says. It's those Christians. They're the bad guys. The common denominator here, on issue after issue, it's these Christians and what they teach. Well, maybe, just maybe, it's not the Christians who picked this fight. There's all this talk these days among Republicans, especially the donor class, about not getting involved in culture war, as if it's the Christians starting a culture war. No. When the Democrats are passing laws in places which say children can be taken away from parents, if the parents say no to so-called gender-affirming care for their students, but by that I mean their sons and their daughters who are students at a public school where they're being indoctrinated in gender ideology, don't tell me that it's the conservatives who need to stay out of the culture war, because you're basically, in that case, telling me that the Democrats own the culture and you like it that way. You want it to stay that way. This whole day of visibility business with regards to transgenderism is an act of wanton aggression in a culture war on the part of the Biden administration and the Democrats. And there's no other way to see it. It is sacrilegious. It is blasphemous. It's demonic. But the real day of visibility is supposed to be Christ's visibility, a day of the visibility of a risen Savior who was arrested. He was subjected to a show trial. He was then handed over to Pontius Pilate and subsequently flogged before ultimately being crucified. He was an innocent man put to death based on a very perverted idea of justice and equity, which basically said, as long as we keep the peace here in Palestine, as long as we don't have riots on our hands and upset Jewish religious leaders, at the end of the day, that's what's best. That's what I'm here for. What is truth? Pontius Pilate asks. I am the way, the truth, and the life, Jesus had said. The best answer would have been for Pontius Pilate to answer his own question, to say, this guy, Jesus is truth. He is the truth, the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father except through him. But then that takes us back a little bit to something more fundamental about the conflict that we have with God as a race. The human race, apart from Jesus, apart from the redemptive work of God in Christ Jesus, is hopelessly in conflict with a holy and righteous God. But by God's grace, he redeems those he foreknew, his chosen ones, his called out ones, to live eternally with him. And in the meantime, between now and when they begin eternity in a new heavens and a new earth, they're here, and God has a purpose for them. God has a purpose for us being here. And it is not to be invisible, but it may be that with the context of this presidential proclamation being much more than just out of the blue, whoa, hey, you know, what's this? A pattern of behavior, a way of relating increasingly hostile, increasingly provocative and disrespectful and contemptuous towards conservative Christians in the U.S., it might be that we need to rethink what honors God best, what loves our neighbors best, what loves our families and our church family best in the way of visibility. We did not go to church on Resurrection Sunday, 2024. And it wasn't because Joe Biden declared a trans day of visibility in the U.S. It's not that. Actually, if you want to know the truth, it was a combination of things, including that two of Lauren's and my sons had pink eye on the one hand, and on the other hand, that our house was a mess, and we had guests expected to come over in the afternoon. And so the best thing we were going to hope for, given that our young boys had pink eye, and we didn't exactly want to go around sharing that and having other people's young kids getting pink eye from our kids. We didn't figure that would be much appreciated. The best case scenario was going to be that my wife was going to stay home and she was going to work on making the meal and preparing the meal. And all of us who didn't have pink eye were going to go on to church. And that was going to be me and most of the kids, you know, pretty much all but the youngest three. So the oldest six. And I come down the stairs and I'm just about ready for us to leave and go out the front door and everybody's dressed and all that. And I'm looking around the house and I'm like, hey, nobody's chores are done. This space is not clean. That space is assigned to you and it's not clean. And this space is assigned to you and it's not clean. And I'm talking to my sons and my daughter and I'm like, hey, we're staying home and we need to have a family meeting about having our chores done and being ready for company. And why are we going in the first place to church? To be seen because it's Easter Sunday. Is that it? I hope not. But here's something I got to thinking about. And I share this with you, not because it's the ideal scenario that you just don't go to church on Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday. That's not what I'm proposing. I got to thinking about it and I thought to myself, you know, if our home is a mess and we have guests coming over in the afternoon, I leave my wife alone with the three youngest, two of whom have pink eye, and she's making the food, and we're gone at church, and we're not all going together as a family, and she's already communicated to me that that, you know, is sad for her. Of course, she would prefer that we all go to church together as a family, especially on Easter. There's an importance to that, which I agree with, and I commend, and I affirm. But I'm thinking, we're going to leave my wife home alone to do all the cleaning and all the cooking and the taking care of these three youngest boys, one who's just a few months old, one who's 2 years old, one who's 5 years old. The rest of us are going to come back after having been seen at church. And my wife, the mother of these children, is going to be exhausted and all stressed out. And for what? And as long as, you know, the people that saw us at church don't see her exhausted and all stressed out, well then, phew, we're good. It's fine. No, actually, it's not fine. If I've got this conviction that actually we should stay home, that that would honor God best for us to stay home, all as a family, and clean up these spaces so that we're ready for company coming over this afternoon to have an Easter meal, what's close to overriding that, that we would have people wondering, well, where are the mullets? Why are they not at church this morning? Oh, I wonder what's the deal. Yeah, you know, I know they've been kind of under the weather here lately, but, you know, man, it's Easter. Yes, it's Easter. It's Resurrection Sunday, which is very important, very, very important. But it needs to be important for the right reason. And one of my concerns about the vulnerability of the American church right now is that a lot of us who do go religiously are first and foremost going religiously for a lot of the same reasons that the Pharisees would do their giving and their praying and their fasting in a very showy way. That is to be seen by men and to be thought more pious for it. To be seen by men is to get your reward now, and it's not to say that you want to be invisible with regards to the people of God. You definitely want to go and be seen and see others and encourage and edify them and build them up. But if you're going to be seen, that's not necessarily to say that you're going to edify others, that you're going to build them up. You're going there because this is what God has called you to. This is what God is going to bless. And a quick test for this is if as soon as you get back in the vehicle to go home and you're on the way home or you get back to your house, you get back in the house, everybody's being awful to each other. They're being inconsiderate. They're being rude. They're neglecting their duties. They're saying hurtful things. Then maybe, just maybe, our God who sees in secret is not fooled. And maybe, just maybe, if that creeps in every now and then for a lot of us or even all of us, when it creeps in, we have to deal with it as it comes. And if some of us are just always in that headspace, and that's the reason why we participate, then here's the next shoe to drop. When the incentive structure says, you know, it's going to look really good, you're not going to church at all, that's going to be a very difficult thing for the folks who want to look really good to respond to. And actually, I think that pretty well sums up a lot of what was revealed with the COVID lockdowns, the 15 days to slow the spread that turned into months of telling people in a lot of places all over the country, all over the U.S., no, you cannot have in-person church services, not even funerals and weddings, but your regular Sunday morning services, no, you're going to have to do that all remote. There were a lot of people who were not just submitting to that because they have such high regard for governing authorities. They were so worried about getting in trouble. There were a lot of people, I firmly believe, who were most worried about violating those don't meet in person for church services orders because they were afraid of people thinking less of them, whether or not it would be obedient to God to disobey that unlawful order. And that is to say that the primary reason they go to church on a regular basis in those cases, in too many cases, is because people who see that they go to church on a regular basis will think that they are good people. You know, upright, upstanding. Maybe it feeds into their political aspirations, or they're a small business owner in the community, and this is really important for their image, that they're trustworthy. You know, you want to shop at my store. You want to come to me for special services that I'll provide, that only I provide, or I'm one of the few people who do, but you go to church with me, so of course you're going to come to me. That's why I go. It's a great place to market. It's a great place to promote myself. Well, that's exactly what the Pharisees were about, and that's why Jesus said, don't do that. If you do that, you've already received your reward, and there is a reward to be had. And it's not to say that you should feel bad if you do get some benefit when you do it for the right reasons, but there happens to be a benefit. But if you're doing it because you just want the benefit right now from people seeing you, then when actually the benefit becomes no benefit at all, you'll drop off. And if the benefit actually turns into a penalty, where you will be openly mocked and jeered at and ridiculed and hated and even persecuted for going to church on a Sunday and worshiping on a Resurrection Sunday together with the saints, you're going to be particularly vulnerable. And so, just speaking for my household, for my being a husband and a father, it seemed to me as though what the Lord wanted for my family this Resurrection Sunday was that we might wean ourselves and our children a little bit off of this paradigm that may make them very vulnerable in the years to come, based on how things have been going in recent years, the past few. It seemed to me as though if the Lord is not particularly impressed with the folks who only go to church Easter Sunday and maybe for a Christmas service, if he's not particularly impressed, as though that's really what he was going for, you know, the don't neglect the assembling of yourselves together as some do, then maybe, just maybe, when some Christians don't attend those two Sundays, so long as the reason is because, hey, our heart's not right, we've got some heart work to do, we've got some talking amongst ourselves to do, some family business to attend to, as far as our attitudes go towards loving and respecting one another in our own home, we're going to attend to that instead of dressing to the nines, going and looking as though we have everything put together, if it's not the case, if it's not genuine. Who's that for, if it's not genuine? And what effect is it going to have? I think in too many cases, we've created something of an expectation that that's what being a good Christian looks like. And this is not at all to knock any of the beautiful families that we are friends with all over the country who posted pictures of themselves with their families at church on Resurrection Sunday. I saw some beautiful update photos of where various families are at, and I'm like, wow, their kids are getting so big. Wow, they all look so nice. That could have been us. You know, there's a little bit of a bittersweetness to realizing we didn't have one of those photos. Now, we had a great one, I think, this past Christmas and Christmas before that. I think we've had some really good family photos, so we can take a good family photo. But if that's what we're going for, if that's the reason we're there, then we're not there for the right reasons. And in that case, maybe we shouldn't be there. Maybe instead of going, we should talk about what are our reasons for going. Hey, are we clear, everybody here? The last thing I want is for my kids to grow up and to say, oh, you know what? Easter and Christmas, those are the two Sundays that I go. And the rest of the year, it's just not a priority. I would rather there be some memorable examples from their childhood where we said, you know, we're staying home. We're staying home because we've got family business we need to attend to, some attitudes that we need to talk about. There's some heart work that we need the Lord to do, and we need to discuss that. On the one hand, what's so concerning about the presidential proclamation is that we have somebody in the White House who has, for decades now of public service, vaunted his being a Roman Catholic. How in the world he's not been excommunicated to this point, I don't know. But every time there's a challenge on some position that he's supporting or he's arguing for, he's insisting on, every time there's a challenge or there's a pushback or there's a question to the press secretary or some member of his administration, well, how does that square with his Roman Catholic faith? The pushback is, the president is a devout Catholic. Now, he's also a person of faith. Spare me. spare me. I don't believe you. But then,
how does that
sort of a thing come to be in the first place? There's the normalization of a show of religion, a public show of religion, to gain some advantage. And if it's not genuine, if it's not real, if it's not sincere, it doesn't bear any relation to actually obeying what God has commanded, living in light of God's revealed word, then folks will get the wrong idea and they'll have a confidence in you that is misplaced. Like, for instance, they might vote for you because you're not an aggressive atheist or you're not some rabid pagan who wants to bring back all the weirdness of ancient deities, human sacrifice and the rest. Oh, you're for human sacrifice, but you just say, you know, everybody should be free to make their own choice with regards to that, and we'll call it abortion. You know, weird stuff with regards to sex, but as long as we say we're just affirming gender, we're just validating and loving our gay, bisexual, lesbian neighbors, and it's fine. You know, because you attend Mass, right? You're a confirmed Catholic. You've never been excommunicated. You're still allowed to take communion or something, I guess. That's what counts. I guess I'll vote for you anyways. I guess you're an okay choice. No. You know, one has to wonder if Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Fourth, this Seleucid king who got the Jews so upset with the business about the pork, you know, if he had converted to Judaism before undertaking all of these defilements of the temple and the Jewish people and their priests, would that have gone over better? If he had tried to normalize what he intended to do for decades or even a century by educating all of the Jewish children in Seleucid schools to the point that the memory had been lost over three or four generations, that there ever was a time before we started talking seriously about sacrificing pigs as burnt offerings in the temple to Yahweh. You know, maybe that would have not led to the Maccabean revolt, right? It would have been fine. Everybody would have gotten used to it. What's the big deal? It's fine. But of course, it wasn't fine what he did. It's not fine what's happening in our cultural context. If we're too addicted to being spoken well of by men and we don't beware of that, if we're too comfortable doing the religious thing that's expected to be seen by men, but when it's privately in our own home, we're not praying, we're not charitable, we're not fasting, then I think we're especially vulnerable to the kind of thing that Antiochus Epiphanes did. And I think we're especially vulnerable to the sort of thing that's being done right now in the United States. And I don't want that. I don't want to be vulnerable. I don't want my family to be vulnerable. I don't want other people that we're in proximity to pick up on that, for it to rub off on them from us, that we just go through the motions. We put on a mask. We show up, we smile, we're dressed nice, act like we've got it all together, like our home is not a mess, like we weren't being ugly to each other right before we got in the vehicle. No, if we're acting like that, if that's okay with us, if we're comfortable with that, then we're not in a good place. So all of that is to say, again, because I think it needs repeated, I'm not trying to make a case for us giving up on Resurrection Sunday or Good Friday. Certainly not Christmas. I love Easter and I love Christmas. You don't like the terms, if you don't like Christmas trees and mistletoe and snowmen and all the rest, whatever, right? Whatever. That's between you and the Lord. I'll pray for you. But what I am saying is we have to be really careful, particularly with how this is ramping up, it seems, that we have a capacity to be criticized, or for people to think less of us when it's not fair, or maybe even it is fair, and maybe just be prepared to be honest when the honest answer is, yeah, a couple of our kids had pink eye. That's embarrassing. Hate to say it. Kind of gross. Yeah, our house was a mess, and we had people coming over in the afternoon, and some of the attitudes with regards to getting ready, not so great. Also kind of gross, kind of not so good. You know, children are children. My wife and I, we are not perfect. Our kids are not perfect either. And I don't know if you know this, you are not perfect. Your family's not perfect. You probably know that by now. And the whole lot of us, I'm not saying we be unwise and do the radical honesty thing. Like Jim Carrey in Liar Liar, you just say whatever pops into your mind. Unfiltered, you know, silence is a choice sometimes too. That's a valid choice to not be lying, to not perjure yourself or give the wrong impression. But we do need to be very careful, especially with the saints, especially when we're talking about Christian fellowship, that it's not fake and it's not a mask. It's not hypocritical. There's this phrasing in the New Testament, let love be genuine, it's translated, but the original is let love be without wax. I've heard that it was the tendency if a statue was cracked at some point while it was being carved or transported, what one might do is take some of the dust from the chipping and the carving and take a little bit of wax, melt the wax, mix in the powder of the marble or whatever it was, and use that pliable hot wax with the marble mixed in to fill in the cracks. And one might do this and get away with the imperfections, and the whole statue might thereby look like there were no cracks. You know, except where the cracks were supposed to be, of course. You know, the carved cracks. You know what I mean? This idea of let love be without wax and genuine is to say you're not trying to cover up the imperfections, as if to cover them up deals with the whole problem. The church and Christian fellowship needs to be such that there's a genuineness, there's a vulnerability that is normalized between the saints, right, between Christians, and that the response to that vulnerability and that honesty is graciousness, it is kindness, it is gentleness. There's a reasonableness, one, for those who are being honest, that they're open to being corrected if what they're saying, what they're doing is not quite correct, but also on the part of those listening and observing that they are willing to offer sympathetic, helpful, compassionate help where it's needed. And before I go, I'll tell you just one little story from this past week. It's a bit of an embarrassing story, but it highlights what I'm talking about, and I think it gives a good example of this actually playing out here very recently. So it happened that at the beginning of the week, we woke up one morning and the house was cold. I checked the thermostat because I was the first one up, and it was set to cool. And I thought, well, maybe it was because the weather was especially nice over the last few days and we needed the air conditioning on actually for a couple of those days. And we just didn't switch it back. We didn't notice at night because we kind of like it cool at night when we're supposed to be sleeping. So I go and I switch the heat back on. I get my cup of coffee. I go back upstairs. By the time I'm getting my second cup of coffee for the morning, the house is still cold. And so I check it again. Huh. Yeah. Thermostat says it's supposed to be heating right now. I check the registers. There's no heat coming out. Well, then I'm a little concerned, but I'm working. And as I'm working, I think, well, okay, but it's not too cold. It's like 60 degrees. It's a little cool for during the daytime. Not our favorite, but maybe once Eli gets up, once my second oldest son wakes up, I'll see if he'll go down and just check out the furnace. You know, it's good practice to learn how to troubleshoot. He can go check it out, see if he can trip a breaker, flip the breaker, see if the switch to power on the furnace got switched off. Maybe somebody was putting something into the utility closet and bumped it or something. He goes down and he says, yeah, the breaker was tripped. I've reset it, but then it tripped again right away. I said, well, okay, you know, how about go check to see that the furnace filter is good. So he goes and replaces the filter and tries it again. And again, right away, it flips the breaker. So I do a little sleuthing online. I am not an HVAC technician, but online I see that what I'm describing to the Google search is Sounds like it could be a blower motor that's gone bad. And if it's that, unless you're a trained HVAC professional, you should probably call a professional to come and service your furnace. I put in a ticket with our property management company. A couple hours go by. There's no response, no answer. I call them and I say, hey, I'm just curious. Did you guys see my ticket? And our house is a bit cold. We've had colds here lately. We've been a little under the weather. Could you give me an update on when somebody's going to come out and take a look at our furnace? Oh, yes. You know, very polite. Oh, yes. We're going to send somebody out. Long and short of it, they sent a HVAC technician out. He checked everything over. It wasn't an issue with the furnace at all. It was an issue of some water dripping down from the ceiling in our utility closet onto an outlet right next to the furnace that was on the same circuit as the furnace. When the water would drip down onto this outlet, it was causing a spark as it was shorting the positive and the negative, and that was tripping the breaker. So then he and I find this, and we go upstairs. I hadn't seen that because it was dark in there, and it was kind of back in the corner, not where I was looking at the furnace up front, and he didn't see it right away either, to be fair. But we go upstairs and we look under the sink, and wouldn't you know it, under the sink is just drenched, very wet. In fact, it looked like it had been wet off and on for quite some time. And I'm not proud to admit that we probably had fixed and then ignored under the kitchen sink back and forth for far too long, and the garbage disposal vibrating was probably what caused there to be a little bit of a leak with the drain pipes underneath the sink. We've got that fixed now. We got everything cleaned out from under the sink. We don't have any more leak issue now. But of course, this HVAC technician, because he's answering a call from the property management company, he reports back to the property management company on his ticket what it is that was actually the issue. And the next thing you know, after that, I'm getting a call from the property management company saying that they are going to be to our house in an hour. Or rather, actually, my wife got the call the next morning that they were going to be at our house in an hour. Here come two men into my house, which is not actually my house because we rent it, but it's our home. We had an hour to get the place clean because obviously if they're wanting to take a look under the sink, they're also going to want to do a more generalized inspection of the house, but we weren't planning on an inspection of the house. Sure enough, they come take a look under the sink. They come take a look in the utility closet. I see them out front after they go to leave, and they're looking at our front yard where we had been doing some spring cleaning. We were getting ready for Greeley dump day, so we were cleaning stuff out to get ready to throw it away. We had knocked down a tree, or rather, my sons had knocked down a tree that was dead in the front yard. They were busy over the course of a few days chopping up the wood. And yeah, we could have gotten that cleaned out sooner. That would have been good. But all of this is to say, it was not looking nearly so pretty as it should have. Our front yard did not look so good. And the inside of our house in various places did not look so good. It was not so clean as I should like, and as I would imagine the property management company should like. Later that afternoon, I get an email from the property management company saying that in 2 days' time, they're going to be sending a property inspector to our house who's going to inspect the entire property. And at that point, my wife and I are looking at this, and we're very stressed out, as you might imagine. Like, oh man, all those things that we were going to get cleaned up that we haven't yet, all of the spring cleaning that was in process, all the stuff out front that we were planning on getting finished up, but now it looks not so good. We've got to get this place cleaned up, and we've got tomorrow to do it. Now, it just so happened that I was off the next day, but I had a cold and was not feeling my best. My wife and I and our kids did not have to clean up our place all on our own. Thankfully, we worked all day long to get the house inside cleaned up, to get the backyard, to get the front yard, to get the garage all sorted out. My dad generously came over and hauled a couple of loads to the Larimer County landfill. tree branches, for instance, leaves that had been raked up. Already, they were already raked up, but they were piled up against the fence, which is not the best look. A couple of items of furniture that just didn't need to be in the yard waiting for Greeley Dump Day anymore with an inspector coming. Various other matters that we attended to that I won't get into detail by detail. But we also had our dear friend, Kate Berkman, come over. We also had our dear friend, our neighbor two houses down, Monica Chavez, and her daughter, hers and JP's daughter, Elise Chavez, come over. JP was at work, but he loaned us a ladder and a tool. Our ladders still need to be gotten back from someone who's been borrowing them for far too long. But JP came through, loaning us his ladder and also a tree trimming tool to get something out of a tree that didn't need to be up there, but it got kind of stuck up there. It didn't look so good. My whole point being, if it had just been us, I don't know how we would have been ready for the inspection. Even with help, it was exhausting and it was last minute, and that's not where we want to be. But all that is to say that sometimes when we're too much about keeping up appearances, out there, we are not paying enough attention to the inside of the cup. That was one of the things that Jesus said about the Pharisees. Not to say we're Pharisees, my wife and I and our kids, but we want to be on guard against the leaven of the Pharisees, as he says, as he calls it. They were like washing a cup on the outside, but not washing the inside of a cup. That's what he likened them to. We don't want to be that way. But sometimes when you're endeavoring to not be that way, in this case, metaphorically, but otherwise, I think it could be applicable in a literal sense. When you want to not be that way, sometimes you have to find people who are going to come into your life and who are going to love you anyways, even though you could use some work. There's going to be an investment of time and attention. And actually, to be quite honest, that's a much better picture of what the church is supposed to be like and about, I believe, when it comes to edification, building up one another with the spiritual gifts that God has given to the members of the body. For what? Mutual edification, mutual dependence. I think that's a much better picture than, hey, we go, we make our appearance, we show up, we're there, everybody gets to see that we're there, perish the thought that they wouldn't see us there. No, by all means, go and be seen, but really be seen, and be seen rightly. Here's the thing about the Trans Day of Visibility, which is so unsettling. There's an implication that trans people are not being seen. Transgendered people are being seen everywhere all the time, way out of proportion with what share of the population they actually are. And so we're actually getting more people who are identifying as transgendered, in part because we're seeing more and more celebration and affirmation of transgendered persons. There's an irony. But there's also an irony in telling broader society that these transgendered people need to be seen, like you're not seeing them. Well, but wait a second. What if we are seeing them and we see very clearly that this man is not a woman and this woman is not a man? What if we're seeing things more clearly than you are as you're calling for a day of visibility? How about that? Wouldn't it be better if you encouraged these transgendered persons to look in the mirror and see themselves rightly? Because maybe they're not seeing themselves rightly. Maybe the issue is not everybody else having an issue with the vision thing. Maybe the issue is denying who they truly are, who God made them to be, and who they actually are. And what if, as part of how we counteract the particular poison of the moment right now, which is trying to inject itself into the lifeblood of the church in America, Christian families, Christian men, women, and children in America right now, what if part of how we work to counteract that or come up with an anti-venom is we wean ourselves a bit off of needing to be seen a certain way because that's how we want people to think of us. Well, but how are we though? How are we really and genuinely? Are we confessing our sins one to another? For instance, for example, Are we providing things honest in the sight of all men? Are we letting our love be genuine, as in without wax? If there are cracks, yeah, there are cracks. Yeah. That's real. Oops. Sorry about that. The beauty of the resurrection, you don't get without the ugliness of the crucifixion. And if not for the beauty of the resurrection, then it's too much to bear. What happened to an innocent man? But then that's just it. Maybe the test of the genuineness of our faith and our love for God, our love for one another, whether we really have been loved by God, and whether we're thinking rightly about what follows from that, how then we should live. Maybe the test is that we're expecting the beauty of sweet, genuine fellowship predicated on providing things honest in the sight of all men instead of trying to look like we've got it all together. Instead of being in competition with one another to appear picture perfect. Now on the flip side, here's my caution and then I'm going to run because I got to go. If it turns out that that is all blessed by God, which I trust that it will be, if we embrace that, it will be. It may lead to actual success. And when the success is genuine, then we definitely should not do the humble bragging thing where we try and do a different kind of fake, right? Oh, you know, I don't want you to see that I'm actually doing very well because you might be embarrassed. I might be embarrassed. You know, that's not going to be seen as fashionable Christian lifestyle. I don't want to be seen as successful. Take a look at David's example, and maybe it'll be instructive. David, being given victory, accomplished God's purpose, and there's no blushing about it in 1 Chronicles chapter 18. There shouldn't be any blushing if we are truly being given victories by God when there's a conflict or there's some big struggle or campaign. Don't blush if it's God who gives the victory. Don't downplay it. Don't paper over it. Just thank God. Similarly, as far as it pertains to managing our own affairs, it may just be that the surest way for us to be doing well is to admit first when we're not doing well. But in due time, maybe God establishes us in the sphere he intends for us. And there we administer justice and equity for everybody who is under our purview. If that's family and the context is the home, if that's church, the context is a congregation, if that's some business and the context is employees, contractors. If God blesses us with success and he establishes us, one really great way to stay humble will be to embrace the challenge of doing justice, loving mercy, walking humbly with our God. But it may be quite some time before we're facing that sort of a challenge where we're really established. Based on how things are going right now, it's looking like the next little while is going to be very challenging, very trying. And we're going to have to be able to be honest with one another as Christians in the context of the church, in the context of Christian families, Christian homes, if we're going to be able to make use of that mutual edification, bearing one another's burdens, peace, which is core and central to how God has instituted and constituted the church. I say we do, but like I said, I got to run. As always, thank you for listening. Until next time, God bless.
You've been listening to The Garrett Ashley Mullet Show on Anchor FM. For more content like what you just heard, subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Also, check out thegarrettashleymulletshow.com to subscribe to email alerts when new episodes are published. As always, you can reach me with any comments, questions, complaints, objections, or insights at garrettashleymullet@protonmail.com.